Okay. Go on, Tilly. This is a Heritage Education Commission interview. The interviewee is Dr. John Holton. The interviewer is Dr. James Oliver. And the date is May the 15th, 1985, the place at St. Ansgar Hospital in Moorhead. Now, Dr. John Holton, would you please give us the date and place of your birth?
I was born, raised, and educated in Grand Forks. I was born March 12, 1928, graduated from the University of North Dakota, undergraduate, and attended medical school there for 2 years, and finished at Temple University in Philadelphia. I finished Temple in 1955. University of North Dakota had a two-year medical school at that time, and at the end of the sophomore year, you had to transfer. I knew that I was going to be returning to this area, so I decided to go way away from the area to get a different perspective. I never had any medicine in my background. Both my brother and I became physicians, but there's no physicians in the family that I'm aware of. I was in the U.S. Army in the medical department, and I became interested in medicine, possibly as a career from that experience. I was in the only peacetime era this country's had in the last 25 years, namely from 1946 to 1948, after World War II and before Korea. My brother likewise graduated from Temple and is now practicing a family practice in Albuquerque, New Mexico. After graduating from medical school, I took a rotating internship at St. Luke's Hospital, Duluth, Minnesota, finishing there in 1956. I then went to work in a three-man group in Cloquet, Minnesota, only 20 miles outside of Duluth, where I was there for a year. I returned to Duluth to do a fellowship with the Duluth Clinic in the Department of Surgery for a year before I decided to move over move back here in the Red River Valley. One day, my wife and I were driving from Duluth to Fargo, and we stopped at the old FM hotel. I went into the hotel to look at the telephone directory, see if I knew any of the physicians there. I didn't recognize anybody, so I picked one out of the hat and came up with Vernon J. Carlson. I called him at 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. He came down and visited me in the old barn at the FM, and by 5 o'clock I knew I was coming to Moorhead. I moved to Moorhead with a 2-month-old infant, a fish aquarium, and a television set. That was a year after the tornado, and there was hardly any houses to be had. Bud Kwame, the realtor, took me around to some of these houses that weren't struck, and none of them interested me, and I told him the only one I wanted was the one that he and his wife were living in. She was out visiting her mother in Portland, and he sold it from right out from underneath her. That house was exorbitantly priced at $17,600, and to compound that, I had a 3.25% interest rate on the mortgage. I worked my fanny off so I could get that albatross of a loan off my back. In those days, we had a call schedule that involved weekend call only, so that there was four of us. There were six of us on the call schedule, which meant that We would be on call once every sixth weekend for everybody, but if you were in town, you made your own hospital rounds and delivered your own babies. We had three children rather rapidly, and I must say that the first 5 years of their life, I hardly got to know them. Almost every night we were down here at the hospital working. There was lots of Mexicans in those days working in the fields. We had all sorts of house calls that were saved up after the office closed at 6, so that many times I didn't get home for supper till 7:30, and by that time the kids were in bed. We would go from house call to house call. Generally, they were infectious cases, and we would be giving penicillin shots, little realizing the hazards of injectable penicillin. Also, I recall there was even a more vicious antibiotic that was a combination of penicillin and streptomycin that was good for almost anything that ailed you. One of our colleagues always walked around with a bottle of Duracellin, Lilly's penicillin, in his pocket.
Well, John, who actually influenced you on your choice of vocation?
I suppose I entered medicine from my experience in the Army. I was in the medical department as a buck sergeant, and got introduced to medicine and got a liking for science. So I suppose that's where that came by. I had originally intended to go into law, which my uncle was a lawyer down in St. Paul, and he was a marvelous role model, and I intended to follow his footsteps, but I fortunately made a change.
John, can you tell me, when you first started in 1958, what your office fees, house fees, and obstetrical fees, so-called confinement fees in those days were?
I came a little bit later during the period of inflation when the office call was $3 a visit, and the house call was $5, and the OB fee, which we called confinement cases, was $75. But that included about 12 prenatal visits, the delivery, the circumcision if it's a boy, and the 6 weeks checkup for mother and mother and baby.
John, you've been very active in community affairs as well as in the practice of medicine. Could you tell us a little bit about your coroner's experience, your C-400 experience, your service club and church membership, please?
When I came to town, I was introduced to the coroner, who was a lovely gentleman, but he ran the local meat market. I felt that there should be somebody in medicine that would make good decisions about causes of death, and I got some support from some local people who nominated me, and I ran for coroner in 1960, and of course was elected. That job at that time was an elected job. It paid $10 per body, and if I couldn't make a determination of the cause of death, we would have coroner's juries where I would sit as sort of a judge and call witnesses, swear them in, pay them $1 a day for their testimony, and then submit the findings to this jury for their determination. I recall several instances where I would bring the jury to the funeral home. If you think the viewing rooms of a funeral home are lovely, you should go out into the business section of those older funeral homes. One of them was in a reconverted bathroom. One time on a hot summer day, there was a four victim fatality from Hawley, and I brought the coroner's jury over to the funeral home in Fargo in the hot basement where the law says I was supposed to swear the jury in over the dead body. Two of them fainted away, and the rest of them tore out outside. I recall even in the nicer funeral homes in town that as the cloth was rolled off the body, that several would kind of melt. I then decided that in spite of the state law, I would swear the jury in other places and show them as little as possible. It got to the point when I walked up and down the street, the businessmen would hide in their office for fear I was going to ask them to be a juror in some grisly accident. Somebody asked me one time how many murders I had participated in, and I said none that I know of. That was true up until about 5 years ago, when the climate became far more volatile and there was far more aggressive behavior. But in those early days, I don't know of anybody that died of violence from murder. At any rate, we did find a few bodies floating in the river that were very suspicious, and I don't think they died of heart attacks, but we couldn't prove anything, and we used all the investigative means we had, which were very very limited. I did the autopsies that were necessary. We didn't have a pathologist in the early days. The pathologists would come from Fargo, and they felt they couldn't participate in a Minnesota criminal action, so they would beg off. I recall many days spending in a morgue with some victim. Later on, I worked with then Senator William Dozeland to draft a legislation which was permissive legislation to allow the counties to appoint medical examiners. This bill would divide the coroner's function, which during my time had been all-encompassing, one of determination of death, investigatory, and judicial, and would divide those functions into the proper areas, so that the judicial would be handled by the county judge, the investigatory would be handled by the appropriate law enforcement agency, and the coroner, or the medical examiner or pathologist, would make the determination of cause of death. This was an excellent bill, but coroners around the state objected to this because it did restrict their freedom of activity, or so they thought. Unfortunately, the coroner's work usually occurred in the middle of the night, and I've been up on highway accidents and in drownings more nights than I care to remember. I resigned on several occasions, only to return for any number of reasons. Ultimately, I quit finally, and John Thomas took over. I'd like to say a word about the County Medical Society, which some of us have been very active in for a good number of years. We had a Clay Becker Medical Society, which basically encompassed Detroit Lakes and Moorhead. In the early days, we would take our wives down to Detroit Lakes, or they would bring theirs here, and one of the ladies would host a reception for the women when we met, usually at the Silver Moon or the Treetop or the Greystone Hotel in Detroit Lakes or the Erie. The function of the County Medical Society changed during that those decades. In the early times, the County Medical Society was an avenue for a physician to gain knowledge, but as specialization came in, every specialist had their own specialty society that he attended and read journals from that society. So the County Medical Society had little to do except some politics. I recall some of us getting very excited when then Senator Magnus Wiefold from Hawley was getting very cozy with the osteopaths, and Dr. Marvin Geib, the only psychiatrist in Fargo and Moorhead at that time, called a meeting in Old St. Ansgar's where we thought we would approach a new upstart lawyer in town who we knew wasn't very busy to run against Magnus. We asked Bill Doeslin to if he'd be interested, and he was, and became a senator, which he handled very capably for many years. The Minnesota Senate was indeed unfortunate when he left that body. He later became a Board of Regents member and contributed well there until he was replaced in a political move. The County Society sort of just existed and still exists just today. There's very little function for the society, and yet there's a lot of pressing issues that should be addressed. We now meet only once a year to elect officers and go home. In the early days, we'd meet at least four times a year, and they were well attended. Dr. Oliver asked about some of the community organizations that I was privileged to participate in. Early in my association in Moorhead, I became very impressed with Concordia College and C400. Although my wife and I are both a graduate of a state-supported institution, we thought the concept of C400 was novel and was worth supporting. I became the national chairman of Project 5, which was to put up the Knutson Center and, incidentally, a swimming pool. We had to use a bit of devious advertising. I didn't think it'd be very easy to sell the farmers in North Dakota a swimming pool, but a building that could be used as a chapel was very appealing, and as much as St. Olaf, Concordia's compatriot down south, had a beautiful chapel and Concordia had none. So we sold the Knutson Center as a chapel and meeting center, and in fact it has been that, and has been a marvelous addition to the campus. That was a project of about $600,000 that we did in 2 years. During those 2 years, I had an opportunity of meeting some of the most fascinating people. 9 months a year, C400 would bring guests onto the campus, such people as Senator Hubert Horatio Humphrey, who and his charming wife Muriel really were a fascinating pair, in spite of what you think about their politics. But there are also other people like Chris Kraft, the developer of in NASA, Colonel Harlan Sanders, the founder of Kentucky Fried Chicken, Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon, and the highlight of the 1 year was Charlie Schultz, the creator of Peanuts. All these people were table guests of mine, of ours, and we enjoyed the visiting with them. I recall Muriel Humphrey sitting next to me when the senator sat next to Carol. I told her that I had delivered the first child with Down syndrome that I'd ever delivered. They recently had a granddaughter with Down syndrome. She wrote the name of my patient on the C-400 program, and lo and behold, about a week later from Washington, my patient and the family received reams of material on how to deal with the Down syndrome. The father of that family was having a very difficult time accepting this tragedy. But Mrs. Humphrey's interest and material was very important in turning around his attitude, and he's been a very supportive father. I was also involved in service clubs, first in the Lions Club, and then finally with Rotary. I enjoy meeting the service club and finding out what's going on in the community and in the nation. The service clubs prevent somebody from becoming terribly provincial. Many times when you sit around the doctor's room, we think that the only people in this country that got any problems are the doctors, when in fact we are probably pretty well off. You really want to hear some tales of woe, you want to go to a service club and hear the small merchant and the farmer and the small small businessman. I also have been, Carol and I and the five kids have been active at Trinity Church in Moorhead. I served on the council once and was sentenced to a second term. Later on, I at one time was vice chairman of the council. That was an interesting experience, and I often wondered how a operation with that kind of money could have been run by 24 volunteers, and why we didn't go broke in the process.
And you came here in 1958. At that time, we were still occupying the old St. Ansgar Hospital. The following year, I believe it was in 59, that we came, that we moved into the new St. Ansgar Hospital. Could you describe your findings that you noted when you first practiced in the old hospital, the role of the sisters, the doctor-nurse relationship, just the general environmental impact of the hospital at that day as compared to the new one?
The old St. Ansgar's Hospital was a typical turn-of-the-century hospital with an operating room on the third floor and a metallic cage for an elevator that most of the time ran. The hospital was run almost entirely by sisters. I don't know the numbers, but there was always a nun in charge of every department. I recall Sister Bernice. She ran the lab. She was in charge of X-ray. She ran medical records, and then for noon and supper, she relieved Ann Griffin on the switchboard. Then when they got through at 7 o'clock, these wonderful women would be allowed an hour where they would all take their handwork and go down in a room and sew, and then to prayers and off to bed. This was a 7-day-a-week proposition, and I could never understand it, how anybody would ever participate in that kind of a life, but these were lovely, dedicated women. In those days, they had the old habits of the starched hat and the black flowing gowns, and I recall the surgeon screaming at the operating room sister that she was sweeping up the bugs all over the floor with her gowns and would make her take tucks in her long gowns so that it didn't touch the floor. The care was that they provided was intimate and caring and very professional. These people were truly dedicated people. This hospital was built at near the turn of the century by the Swedish Lutheran Church, and it was called Northwestern Hospital. This hospital fell on hard times, and the Sisters of St. Francis of Little Falls purchased that hospital and has operated it since. I was privileged to work in that hospital only 1 year before we moved in January 1960?
59.
Into the new facility. The nuns were very kind and considerate. They were very courteous towards us, no matter what they thought of us. Our relationship was always very warm. The first administrator that I can recall that I knew was Sister Joseph, who was here when the new hospital was opened. She ran this hospital with no other administrative staff until the accounts receivable got so bad that they hired Adolf Olson to come in to be the credit manager. In spite of being the only administrator, every morning she was on the floors from 7 till 9, visiting every floor and almost every patient room before she started her work in the office. Now she's been replaced by about 10.
John, when you first came to Moorhead, you joined Dr. E.W. Humphrey Sr. and Vern Carlson. Could you tell us a little bit about these fine gentlemen and your relationship with them in practice?
I joined Dr. E.W. Humphrey and Dr. V.J. Carlson down in what was known as the Moorhead Clinic. This was on the back end of the American State Bank building downtown in a small office. E.W. Humphrey was an older man at that time, but he came down to the office almost every day, watching who went into these young whippersnappers' offices, generally keeping track of what was going on. He was a fine old gentleman, and could tell stories of the early days of this area and medicine beyond belief. I recall the large picture above his desk of a football game of Iowa State against Montana, played on an open field out in Montana. Doc Humphrey played for Iowa State in the late 1890s. One of his teammates was Jim Thorpe, who Pop Warner took from Iowa State with him to Carlisle Barracks, where he made a name for himself in football. In those days, the football players had very little padding and almost no helmet, and there's a picture of Doc in his football gear. Vern Carlson was a magnificent physician and an individual, kind, considerate, warm, empathetic, and a marvelous associate. I spent the first several years just doing his overflow, he was always very, very, very supportive. I don't recall a disagreement that we ever had. In fact, I think one of his problems was that he couldn't release his frustrations that everybody has sometime along the line. He worked hard, practiced excellent medicine, and was a fine associate. After we left downtown, we moved out to 1015 7th Avenue North, directly south of St. Ansgar's Hospital, where the four of us built a building. At that time, we invited Dr. Ron Kolb, a dentist, to join us, and the three drugstores downtown formed a pharmacy corporation which operated the pharmacy. Dr. Thysel moved in from Hawley, and Dr. Bart Rice, whose office was upstairs over Rudy Gluttony's bar, joined us in the office across from St. Ansgar's.
John, in view of the fact that medicine is increasingly being influenced and directed by corporate organizations and government interference, what do you see as its future status? Simply the bottom line type of philosophy versus the quality of medicine and the loss of personal and professional freedom for physicians. It's been stated that any loss of personal freedom demoralizes and diminishes all those affected and ultimately leads to a destruction of the soul. What would be your comments on this important matter?
There's been a marked change in philosophy and attitudes in life in general and more particularly in medicine during the 25 years that I've been here. In the early days, up to just recently, there was a strong patient-doctor relationship. People were very, very supportive of their physician, and the patient-doctor relationship, once that relationship was there, it was more or less cemented. This has changed in the last years, some for the good and some for the bad. We are seeing people far more interested now in seeking medical care based on convenience and price. The relationship they've had with their doctor has eroded somewhat due to many factors, probably not the least of which is a change in the economy. The corporate practice of medicine is certainly upon us. Almost everybody in medicine was in solo practice in the early days, except for the megaliths, Mayo Clinic, Leahy Clinic, Fargo Clinic, St. Louis Park Clinic, and such. But outside of those clinics, which were unique to the Midwest, generally, except for Leahy and Ochsner, most everybody else was an independent practice. These relationships changed, and now there are larger and larger groups, and it is anticipated that by the year 2000 there will probably be 20 large conglomerates of doctors in the United States. This, as you can imagine, is going to have some profound effects on people. There's a surplus of physicians. People are having unreasonable expectations. So we are witnessing a litigious society where there's a lack of strong patient-doctor relationship as there was in the past. All this leads to increase litigation and malpractice, which is a very serious thing at this point. It is a fact now in Florida that almost all family physicians and only one third of the almost all family physicians and one third of the obstetricians have quit doing obstetrics. This is at the same time when the government is espousing a midwifery. Which I can't understand, but whatever. There is this change in attitudes of people, doctor and patient alike. The last decade, I'm afraid, has shown not the best side of the practicing physician. In many instances, it has been a fact that the incomes of physicians have been exorbitant. And that society has not accepted that without comment. Nobody denies physicians good incomes, but 10 years ago, those fees and those yearly incomes were far and away higher than any profession in America, except possibly the sports figures. But that, combined with our litigious society, have made a adversarial relations in too many instances between patient and doctor. You know, I see things happening, such as physicians going into shopping centers and Sears hiring physicians as for convenience sake. It's going to be difficult to accept, but if somebody is young and doesn't know any better, maybe he can fall into that kind of a practice module without any problem.
John, would it be difficult for you to, quote, start again in this present changing medical climate?
It would be difficult for me to start again, and yet I don't think I hesitate to advise somebody to start. For those of us that have gone through the golden era of medicine, this would be a terrible letdown. And yet, not everything has gone to the dogs. In the early days, when we didn't have as many, especially colleagues, as we do now, we were doing far more than we were adequately trained to do. And now it is much more comforting to have expert help right alongside. I never felt threatened by the specialists. They were my colleagues and fellow workers, and I never had an ego trip that I had to do everything from neurosurgery to internal medicine. But I was very glad to share a lot of those very difficult cases with a proper specialist. But I think I would have problems coming out now and being hired by a corporate board, working in a hospital that is run by a for-profit institution whose bottom line is profit. It's just against my philosophy. But if I didn't know any better, the young people coming out don't know any better, and they'll probably accept it.
And now for the years ahead before your retirement for the plans for your retirement, what would your comments be relative to these?
I've been a party to the changes in medicine that have evolved here. As I said, we started out all solo. Later on, went into a two-man group and a three-man group, and prided myself that we have independent practice. Last year, our practice was acquired by the Fargo Clinic, so that instead of being in a three-man group, I am now in a 180-man group. My freedom is not my own. However, there are flip sides to that. I don't concern myself about personnel policy matters, about collections, about government forms and bureaucracies that have to be done by the practicing physicians solo. So I anticipate that I will stay with this kind of an arrangement until I retire. We have five children. John was born in 57, Karen in 58, Paul in 59. And then Eric was born in 63, and then Andrea, our caboose, came along in 1971. So she is going to be finishing high school about the time that I plan to retire. Many of my friends have their family out of the nest and are enjoying a leisure. I'm still going back to school and going to parents-teachers conferences, which is a little strange. Some of the teeny boppers that come there with their kids never know whether I'm a parent or a grandparent, but that's okay. Many of my friends of my age are worrying about their bowels, and I'm worrying about football games and basketball games. I will stay in active practice, God willing, and my health holding out until such time as I quit or I'm thrown out. I want to stay in town. This is a marvelous community. There's lots of events and activities to participate in. I couldn't find a place in the nation where there's as much going on and there's such an ease of access as these two towns. The weather is not ideal, but we don't have any bums sleeping under our bridges. They really want to live in town to stay around here. So it's got a lot of advantages. I would like to get out of town in the winter time. We have a home in Phoenix that belonged to my in-laws before they passed away. So someday we'll be spending some time down there. But I intend to make Moorhead my retirement home.
Thank you, John, for participating in this heritage program as chairman of the medical section, and also for your time and the sharing of your experiences and views. I'm Dr. James Oliver.